Chapter 15. Geneva. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, written in 1818, is largely set in Geneva, the bustling, neat, clean, clockwork-organized Swiss city where I now made my home. Like many Americans, I'd grown up watching the various movie versions and TV cartoons, but I'd never actually read the book. In the days before I left the States, however, I'd been searching for what to read about Geneva, and in nearly all the lists I found online, Frankenstein stood out from among the tourist guides and histories. In fact, I think the only PDFs I downloaded for the flight over were Frankenstein and the Geneva Conventions, and I only finished the former. I did my reading at night over the long, lonely months I spent by myself before Lindsay moved over to join me, stretched out on a bare mattress in the living room of the comically fancy, comically vast, but still almost entirely unfurnished apartment that the embassy was paying for on the Quai de Sujet in the Saint-Jean-Falaise district, with the Rhone out one window and the Jura Mountains out the other. Suffice it to say, the book wasn't what I expected. Frankenstein is an epistolary novel that reads like a thread of overwritten emails, alternating scenes of madness and gory murder, with a cautionary account of the way technological innovation tends to outpace all moral, ethical, and legal restraints. The result is the creation of an uncontrollable monster. In the intelligence community, the Frankenstein effect is widely cited, though the more popular military term for it is blowback. Situations in which policy decisions intended to advance American interests end up harming them irreparably. Prominent examples of the Frankenstein effect, cited by after-the-fact civilian, governmental, military, and even IC assessments, have included America's funding and training of the Mujahideen to fight the Soviets, which resulted in the radicalization of Osama bin Laden and the founding of Al-Qaeda, as well as the de-Ba'athification of the Saddam Hussein-era Iraqi military, which resulted in the rise of the Islamic State. Without a doubt, however, the major instance of the Frankenstein effect over the course of my brief career can be found in the U.S. government's clandestine drive to restructure the world's communications. In Geneva, in the same landscape where Mary Shelley's creature ran amok, America was busy creating a network that would eventually take on a life and mission of its own and wreak havoc on the lives of its creators, mine very much included. The CIA station in the American Embassy in Geneva was one of the prime European laboratories of this decades-long experiment. The city, the refined old-world capital of family banking and an immemorial tradition of financial secrecy, also lay at the intersection of EU and international fiber-optic networks, and happened to fall just within the shadow of key communication satellites circling overhead. The CIA is the primary American intelligence agency dedicated to HUMINT, human intelligence, or covert intelligence gathering by means of interpersonal contact, person-to-person, face-to-face, unmediated by a screen. The COs, case officers, who specialized in this, were terminal cynics, charming liars who smoked, drank, and harbored deep resentment toward the rise of SIGINT, signals intelligence, or covert intelligence gathered by means of intercepted communications, which, with each passing year, reduced their privilege and prestige. But though the COs had a general distrust of digital technology, reminiscent of Frank's back at headquarters, they certainly understood how useful it could be, which produced a productive camaraderie and a healthy rivalry. Even the most cunning and charismatic CO will, over the course of their career, come across at least a few zealous idealists whose loyalties they can't purchase with envelopes stuffed with cash. That was typically the moment when they'd turn to technical field officers like myself with questions, compliments, and party invitations. To serve as a technical field officer among these people was to be as much a cultural ambassador as an expert advisor, introducing the case officers to folkways and customs of a new territory no less foreign to most Americans than Switzerland's 26 cantons and 4 official languages. On Monday, a CO might ask my advice on how to set up a covert online communications channel with a potential turncoat they were afraid to spook. On Tuesday, another CO might introduce me to somebody they'd say was a specialist in from Washington, though this was in fact the same CO from the day before, now testing out a disguise that I'm still embarrassed to say I didn't suspect in the least, though I suppose that was the point. On Wednesday, I might be asked how best to destroy after transmitting, the technological version of burn after reading, a disk of customer records that a CO had managed to purchase from a crooked Swisscom employee. On Thursday, I might have to write up and transmit security violation reports on COs, documenting minor infractions like forgetting to lock the door to a vault when they'd gone to the bathroom, a duty I'd perform with considerable compassion, since I once had to write up myself for exactly the same mistake. Come Friday, the chief of operations might call me into his office to ask me if, hypothetically speaking, headquarters could send over an infected thumb drive that could be used by someone to hack the computers used by delegates to the United Nations, whose main building was just up the street. Did I think there was much of a chance of this someone being caught? I didn't, and they weren't. In sum, during my time in the field was rapidly changing. The agency was increasingly adamant that COs enter the new millennium, and technical field officers like myself were tasked with helping them do that, in addition to all of our other duties. We put them online, and they put up with us. Geneva was regarded as ground zero for this transition because it contained the world's richest environment of sophisticated targets, from the global headquarters of the United Nations to the home offices of numerous specialized UN agencies and international non-governmental organizations. There was the International Atomic Energy Agency, which promotes nuclear technology and safety standards worldwide, including those that relate to nuclear weaponry. The International Telecommunication Union, which, through its influence over technical standards for everything from the radio spectrum to satellite orbits, determines what can be communicated and how. And the World Trade Organization, which, through its regulation of the trade of goods, services, and intellectual property among participating nations, determines what can be sold and how. Finally, there was Geneva's role as the capital of private finance, which allowed great fortunes to be stashed and spent without much public scrutiny, regardless of whether those fortunes were ill-gotten or well-earned. The notoriously slow and meticulous methods of traditional spycraft certainly had their successes in manipulating these systems for America's benefit, but ultimately too few to satisfy the ever-increasing appetite of the American policymakers who read the IC's reports, especially as the Swiss banking sector, along with the rest of the world, went digital. With the world's deepest secrets now stored on computers, which were more often than not connected to the open internet, it was only logical that America's intelligence agencies would want to use those very same connections to steal them. Before the advent of the internet, if an agency wanted to gain access to a target's computer, it had to recruit an asset who had physical access to it. This was obviously a dangerous proposition. The asset might be caught in the act of downloading the secrets or of implanting the exploitative hardware and software that would radio the secrets to their handlers. The global spread of digital technology simplified this process enormously. The new world of digital network intelligence, or computer network operations, meant that physical access was almost never required, which reduced the level of human risk and permanently realigned the human-SIGINT balance. An agent now could just send the target a message, such as an email, with attachments or links that unleashed malware that would allow the agency to surveil not just the target's computer, but its entire network. Given this innovation, the CIA's HUMINT would be dedicated to the identification of targets of interest, and SIGINT would take care of the rest. instead of a CO cultivating a target into an asset through cash-on-the-barrel bribery or coercion and blackmail if the bribery failed, a few clever computer hacks would provide a similar benefit. What's more, with this method, the target would remain unwitting in what would inevitably be a cleaner process. That, at least, was the hope. But as intelligence increasingly became cyber intelligence, a term used to distinguish it from the old phone and fax forms of offline SIGINT, old concerns also had to be updated to the new medium of the internet. For example, how to research a target while remaining anonymous online. This issue would typically emerge when a CO would search the name of a person from a country like Iran or China in the agency's databases and come up empty-handed. For casual searches of prospective targets like these, no results was actually a fairly common outcome. The CIA's databases were mostly filled with people already of interest to the agency, or citizens of friendly countries whose records were more easily available. When faced with a no results, a CO would have to do the same thing you do when you want to look someone up. They'd turn to the public internet. This was risky. Normally, when you go online, your request for any website travels from your computer more or less directly to the server that hosts your final destination, the website you're trying to visit. At every stop along the way, however, your request cheerfully announces exactly where on the internet it came from and exactly where on the internet it's going, thanks to identifiers called source and destination headers, which you can think of as the address information on a postcard. Because of these headers, your internet browsing can easily be identified as yours by, among others, webmasters, network administrators, and foreign intelligence services. It may be hard to believe, but the agency at the time had no good answer for what a case officer should do in this situation beyond weakly recommending that they ask CIA headquarters to take over the search on their behalf. Formally, the way this ridiculous procedure was supposed to work was that someone back in McLean would go online from a specific computer terminal and use what was called a non-attributable research system. This was set up to proxy, that is, fake the origin of, a query before sending it to Google. If anyone tried to look into who had run that particular search, all they would find would be an anodyne business located somewhere in America, one of the myriad fake executive headhunter or personnel services companies the CIA used as cover. I can't say that anyone ever definitively explained to me why the agency liked to use job search businesses as a front. Presumably, they were the only companies that might plausibly look up a nuclear engineer in Pakistan one day and a retired Polish general the next. I can say with absolute certainty, however, that the process was ineffective, onerous, and expensive. To create just one of these covers, the agency had to invent the purpose and name of a company, secure a credible physical address somewhere in America, register a credible URL, put up a credible website, and then rent servers in the company's name. Furthermore, the agency had to create an encrypted connection from those servers that allowed it to communicate with the CIA network without anyone noticing the connection. Here's the kicker. After all of that effort and money was expended just to let us anonymously Google a name, whatever front business was being used as a proxy would immediately be burned, by which I mean its connection to the CIA would be revealed to our adversaries, the moment some analysts decided to take a break from their research to log into their personal Facebook account on that same computer. Since few of the people at headquarters were undercover, that Facebook account would often openly declare, "I work at the CIA," or, just as tellingly, "I work at the State Department, but in McLean." Go ahead and laugh. Back then, it happened all the time. During my stint in Geneva, whenever a CO would ask me if there was a safer, faster, and all-around more efficient way to do this, I introduced them to Tor. The Tor project was a creation of the state that ended up becoming one of the few effective shields against the state's surveillance. Tor is free and open source software that, if used carefully, allows its users to browse online with the closest thing to perfect anonymity that can be practically achieved at scale. Its protocols were developed by the U.S. Naval Research Laboratory throughout the mid-1990s, and in 2003, it was released to the public, to the worldwide civilian population on whom its functionality depends. This is because Tor operates on a cooperative community model, relying on tech-savvy volunteers all over the globe who run their own Tor servers out of their basements, attics, and garages. By routing its users' internet traffic through these servers, Tor does the same job of protecting the origin of that traffic as the CIA's non-attributable research system, with the primary difference being that Tor does it better, or at least more efficiently. I was already convinced of this, but convincing the gruff COs was another matter altogether. With the Tor protocol, your traffic is distributed and bounced around through randomly generated pathways from Tor server to Tor server, with the purpose being to replace your identity as the source of a communication with that of the last Tor server in the constantly shifting chain. Virtually none of the Tor servers, which are called layers, know the identity of or any identifying information about the origin of the traffic. And in a true stroke of genius, the one Tor server that does know the origin, the very first server in the chain, does not know where the traffic is headed. Put more simply, the first Tor server that connects you to the Tor network, called a gateway, knows you're the one sending a request. But because it isn't allowed to read that request, it has no idea whether you're looking for pet memes or information about a protest. And the final Tor server that your request passes through, called an exit, knows exactly what's being asked for, but has no idea who's asking for it. This layering method is called onion routing, which gives Tor its name, the onion router. The classified joke was that trying to surveil the Tor network makes spies want to cry. Therein lies the project's irony. Here was a U.S. military-developed technology that made cyber intelligence simultaneously harder and easier, applying hacker know-how to protect the anonymity of IC officers, but only at the price of granting that same anonymity to adversaries and to average users across the globe. In this sense, Tor was even more neutral than Switzerland. For me personally, Tor was a life changer, bringing me back to the internet of my childhood by giving me just the slightest taste of freedom from being observed. None of this account of the CIA's pivot to cyber intelligence, or SIGINT on the internet, is meant to imply that the agency wasn't still doing some significant human in the same manner in which it had always done so, at least since the advent of the modern IC in the aftermath of World War II. Even I got involved, though my most memorable operation was a failure. Geneva was the first and only time in my intelligence career in which I made the personal acquaintance of a target, the first and only time that I looked directly into the eyes of a human being, rather than just recording their life from afar. I have to say, I found the whole experience unforgettably visceral and sad. Sitting around discussing how to hack a faceless UN complex was psychologically easier by a wide margin. Direct engagement, which can be harsh and emotionally draining, simply doesn't happen that much on the technical side of intelligence, and almost never in computing. There is a depersonalization of experience fostered by the distance of a screen. Peering at life through a window can ultimately abstract us from our actions and limit any meaningful confrontation with their consequences. I met a man at an embassy function, a party. The embassy had lots of those, and the COs always went, drawn as much by the opportunities to spot and assess potential candidates for recruitment as by the open bars and cigar salons. Sometimes the COs would bring me along. I'd lectured them on my specialty long enough, I guess, that now they were all too happy to lecture me on theirs, cross-training me to help them play spot the sap in an environment where there were always more people to meet than they could possibly handle on their own. My native geekiness meant I could get the young researchers from CERN, Conseil Européen pour la Recherche Nucléaire, the European Council for Nuclear Research, talking about their work with a voluble excitement that the MBAs and political science majors who comprise the ranks of our COs had trouble provoking on their own. As a technologist, I found it incredibly easy to defend my cover. The moment some bespoke-suited cosmopolite asked me what I did, and I responded with the four words, I work in IT, or in my improving French, je travaille dans l'informatique, their interest in me was over. Not that this ever stopped the conversation. When you're a fresh-faced professional in a conversation outside your field, it's never that surprising when you ask a lot of questions. And in my experience, most people will jump at the chance to explain exactly how much more they know than you do about something they care about deeply. The party I'm recalling took place on a warm night on the outside terrace of an upscale cafe on one of the side streets alongside Lake Geneva. Some of the COs wouldn't hesitate to abandon me at such a gathering if they had to in order to sit as close as possible to whatever woman happened to match their critical intelligence value indicators of being highly attractive and no older than a student. But I wasn't about to complain. For me, spotting targets was a hobby that came with a free dinner. I took my plate and sat down at a table next to a well-dressed Middle Eastern man in a cuff-linked, demonstratively Swiss pink shirt. He seemed lonely and totally exasperated that no one seemed interested in him, so I asked him about himself. That's the usual technique. Just be curious and let them talk. In this case, the man did so much talking that it was like I wasn't even there. He was Saudi. And he told me about how much he loved Geneva, the relative beauties of the French and Arabic languages, and the absolute beauty of this one Swiss girl with whom he, yes, had a regular date playing laser tag. With a touch of conspiratorial tone, he said that he worked in private wealth management. Within moments, I was getting a full-on polished presentation about what exactly makes a private bank private, and the challenge of investing without moving markets when your clients are the size of sovereign wealth funds. Your clients? I asked. That's when he said, most of my work is on Saudi accounts. After a few minutes, I excused myself to go to the bathroom, and on the way there, I leaned over to tell the CEO who worked finance targets what I'd learned. After a necessarily too long interval fixing my hair, or texting Lindsay in front of the bathroom mirror, I returned to find the CO sitting in my chair. I waved to my new Saudi friend before sitting down beside the CO's discarded, smoky-eyed date. Rather than feeling bad, I felt like I'd really earned the pavé de Genève that were passed around for dessert. My job was done. The next day, the CO, whom I'll call Cal, heaped me with praise and thanked me effusively. COs are promoted or passed over based primarily on how effective they are at recruiting assets with access to information on matters substantial enough to be formally reported back to headquarters. And given Saudi Arabia's suspected involvement in financing terror, Cal felt under tremendous pressure to cultivate a qualifying source. I was sure that in no time at all, our fellow party guest would be getting a second paycheck from the agency. That was not quite how it worked out, however. Despite Cal's regular forays with the banker to strip clubs and bars, the banker wasn't warming up to him, at least not to the point where a pitch could be made, and Cal was getting impatient. After a month of failures, Cal was so frustrated that he took the banker out drinking and got him absolutely plastered. Then he pressured the guy to drive home drunk instead of taking a cab. Before the guy had even left the last bar of the night, Cal was calling the make and plate number of his car to the Geneva police, who not 15 minutes later arrested him for driving under the influence. The banker faced an enormous fine, since in Switzerland, fines aren't flat sums, but based on a percentage of income. And his driver's license was suspended for 3 months. A stretch of that time, Cal would spend, as a truly wonderful friend with a fake guilty conscience, driving the guy back and forth between his home and work, daily, so that the guy could keep his office from finding out. When the fine was levied, causing his friend cash flow problems, Cal was ready with a loan. The banker had become dependent, the dream of every CO. There was only one hitch. When Cal finally made the pitch, the banker turned him down. He was furious, having figured out the planned crime and the engineered arrest, and he felt betrayed that Cal's generosity hadn't been genuine. He cut off all contact. Cal made a half-hearted attempt to follow up and do damage control, but it was too late. The banker who'd loved Switzerland had lost his job and was returning, or being returned, to Saudi Arabia. Cal himself was rotated back to the States. Too much had been hazarded, too little had been gained. It was a waste, which I myself had put in motion and then was powerless to stop. After that experience, the prioritizing of SIGINT over HUMINT made all the more sense to me. In the summer of 2008, the city celebrated its annual Fête de Genève, a giant carnival that culminates in fireworks. I remember sitting on the left bank of Lake Geneva with the local personnel of the SCS, or Special Collection Service, a joint CIA-NSA program responsible for installing and operating the special surveillance equipment that allows U.S. embassies to spy on foreign signals. These guys worked down the hall from my vault at the embassy, but they were older than I was, and their work was not just way above my pay grade, but way beyond my abilities. They had access to NSA tools that I didn't even know existed. Still, we were friendly. I looked up to them, and they looked out for me. As the fireworks exploded overhead, I was talking about the banker's case, lamenting the disaster it had been, when one of the guys turned to me and said, "Next time you meet someone, Ed, don't bother with the COs. Just give us his email address and we'll take care of it." I remember nodding somberly to this, though at the time, I barely had a clue of the full implications of what that comment meant. I steered clear of parties for the rest of the year and mostly just hung around the cafes and parks of Saint-Jean-Falaise with Lindsay, taking occasional vacations with her to Italy, France, and Spain. Still, something had soured my mood, and it wasn't just the banker debacle. Come to think of it, maybe it was banking in general. Geneva is an expensive city and unabashedly posh, but as 2008 drew to a close, its elegance seemed to tip over into extravagance, with a massive influx of the super rich, most of them from the Gulf states, many of them Saudi, enjoying the profits of peak oil prices on the cusp of the global financial crisis. These royal types were booking whole floors of five-star grand hotels and buying out the entire inventories of the luxury stores just across the bridge. They were putting on lavish banquets at the Michelin-starred restaurants and speeding their chrome-plated Lamborghinis down the cobbled streets. It would be hard at any time to miss Geneva's display of conspicuous consumption. But the profligacy now on display was particularly galling, coming as it did during the worst economic disaster, as the American media kept telling us, since the Great Depression, and as the European media kept telling us, since the interwar period and Versailles. It wasn't that Lindsay and I were hurting. After all, our rent was being paid by Uncle Sam. Rather, it's that every time she or I would talk to our folks back home, the situation seemed grimmer. Both of our families knew people who'd worked their entire lives, some of them for the U.S. government, only to have their homes taken away by banks after an unexpected illness made a few mortgage payments impossible. To live in Geneva was to live in an alternative, even opposite reality. As the rest of the world became more and more impoverished, Geneva flourished. And while the Swiss banks didn't engage in many of the types of risky trades that caused the crash, they gladly hid the money of those who'd profited from the pain and were never held accountable. The 2008 crisis, which laid so much of the foundation for the crises of populism that a decade later would sweep across Europe and America, helped me realize that something that is devastating for the public can be, and often is, beneficial to the elites. This was a lesson that the U.S. government would confirm for me in other contexts time and again in the years ahead.